Oh, turn the close that. Yeah, close that door. Good afternoon. This is Debbie Q with The Right Shoe. And again, I forgot the record button. I don't know what is going on with me lately. Oh my God, my brain. My brain is on fire. I was just talking about today is Sunday. Now, I want to do justice because Jesse Pollock, who wrote The Acid King, and he wrote Death and the Devil's Teeth by Jesse Pollock. He wrote two fantastic books. I did an interview with him, and because after this podcast episode, I'm going to take just a break until the holidays are coming. Last year, I had a little bit more time. I just have no time lately. I really like to do podcast episodes that I feel are worthy. If I don't feel that they're, you know, where they should be, it drives me nuts. So I don't feel that I'm giving it my all. I have been doing lives on YouTube. I just interviewed a woman named Louise, and she was a madam in Australia, which it's fascinating. So if you're a YouTuber, go onto YouTube, The Right Shoe. I have all my episodes up there and also a few lives. I think I interview Gisela Kay. I interview Marvin. I interview Lyndon from Murder at Bedtime with Lyndon, and I interview Louise. Now, I'm hoping to even do some lives while I'm on this break. It's only going to be until January because I want to spend time with my family and my daughter. You know, she's not little anymore, so as much as I can get to her, I'm taking, you know, I want her. I miss her. And today I found out something devastating. Just devastating. My friend Marvin Stafford, God bless him. He was 88 years old and he passed away. Now, Marvin was special to me. Now, I'm older than most of the people doing, you know, I feel like when I go onto Instagram, my gosh, I feel like grandma. Now, back when I wrote books. I have a book, The Bend and Dyke Community, that is still shelved. It never saw the light of day because I almost got this girl, Lori Pope, to publish it, but 9/11 happened and it just really, everything stopped for a brief moment in time. Now, Marvin Stafford was the one who used to really push me to write. I got a lot of stuff. Back then, there were zines, at least, and in the late 90s. I was trying to get this book published, but it just never came to fruition. Now, Marvin, we always kept in touch. Marvin meant a lot to me. He was 88 years old. He just passed away 3 months ago. I didn't even know. His son called me today. He said, you know, his mother kept saying, you got to call this girl because she's looking for Marvin and she obviously doesn't know. So that's why the next episode is probably going to be in January. And I'm going to do I've had several people ask me to do episode about Charles Manson. I really always wanted to do. Now, Sharon Tate was I just love Sharon Tate. Absolutely loved her. I love Valley of the Dolls, which she was in. I loved Jacqueline Suzanne, who wrote Valley of the Dolls. So the point is that I was such a Sharon Tate fan, and the way she was brutally murdered by, not by Charles Manson himself, but by the people that were under his, you know, beck and call. And it wasn't just that. It's that, like, I'll just tell you this real quick. There's so much interesting things that go into that. Like the night that they killed Sharon Tate and, you know, Stephen Parent and Wojciech Jankowski. I'm sorry if I mispronounced his name. And Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring. The night they killed those five people. You know, it's just, you look back now, the one girl has died. She died. Susan Atkins, she had passed away. Squeaky Fromm is a Manson girl, but she tried to kill Gerald Ford and it was unsuccessful. The gun jammed. So she's not a part of it, but it will include all of these girls, all that went into it, not just the Sharon Tate murders. Also, that night, which I always found fascinating, was the fact that Patricia Kramwinkle was there, Susan Atkins. I think who was more violent than Charles Manson was Tex Watson. I mean, that guy was an absolute murderous maniac. He was murder with a capital M. So, you know, he was sick. They were all sick, but Tex Watson was number one sicko. And people forget about him. But there was one girl, Leslie Van Houten, who was a beauty queen, and she fell under Manson's spell. And she's still trying to get out. I mean, she actually got out in the 70s. They had released her from jail. They were like, you're fine, you're good to go. But she had to come back. Now, they were actually not going to retry her. She was going to be let go in the 70s. But for whatever reason, they got her, and she's still in jail to this day. And she's still saying, like, I shouldn't even be in here. And it all stems back to the 70s when she was released. So much goes into it. And she wanted to be there the night that they killed Sharon Tate. She was furious with Charles Manson that he did not let her go. And then the next night when they killed the LaBiancas, she went. And she stuck a fork inside Lino LaBianca's stomach. I mean, she was sick. It's just amazing to me that they're still in jail. I will give, in today's world, I don't think they would have gotten that much time. They probably would have been released. But, you know, there was a girl who did, I shouldn't even be getting into all this. Suffice it to say, I will get into all of this, mostly about the Manson girls, because like Patricia Kramwinkle, she has no idea what she was a part of. They called her, quote, I'm not saying this, I'm not using this term for her. Somebody called her a mental midget. And they said that because they said she still has no idea what she did. And I believe that to be true. She really is just clueless when it comes to the fact that she was a part of like one of the biggest murders, like Jack the Ripper, the Manson murders, and OJ. You know, that's what sticks in your mind when you think of murders. And yes, OJ was not convicted. He was innocent in the jury of his peers. So I really can't legally include him. The point is it's a fascinating tale. And it just goes deeper than just Charles Manson, deeper than Sharon Tate. And I would like to take that on. People have been asking me that, and I will do it, but it's going to be after the holidays. So in the meantime, today, I had such a spectacular interview with the writer of the two books, The Acid King, and he also wrote Death at the Devil's Teeth. Now, the reason they wrote this, Death at the Devil's Teeth, is because it's so crazy. Let him do the explanation. I'm just going to go over a little bit about Jeanette DePalma. What happened was, I was always fascinated with this book called Say You Love Satan. And it was about this Ricky Casso who killed his friend Gary Lawlers. And I don't know if I should say this already, but what happens after that, I'll go through it. But anyway, Ricky Casso kills his friend. And then this other book, The Acid King, comes out. And everyone was saying the first book was so sensationalized. It was all about satanic panic. It wasn't worth its salt, you know. And I'm thinking, wow, let me read this Acid King book. So I read it, and it was so much different than, say, You Love Satan. And the reason they call it that is because when Ricky Casso was killing his friend Gary, who stole 10 bags of PCP from him, that's why he killed him. But we'll get into other reasons why we think he was killed as well. Ricky Casso said, say you love Satan. And Gary said, I love my mother. So hence, that's how it came out. But it's supposedly he was really into this Satanism. And Jesse Pollock came out. He writes, Weird New Jersey magazine. It's been out for many years. I used to read it all the time. It's still available at like Barnes and Noble. And it's just amazing how they just twisted a little to make it like this fascinating story as what the people wanted to hear, as opposed to what the real story was. So then I didn't realize that he had also wrote the book about Jeanette DePalma. And I was like, oh my God, that is amazing. So here is our interview. I'm going to go first through a little bit about the murders, and then I'm just going to let the interview, you know, speak for itself. I'm going to just say what happened, both murders, and then I'm going to play the interview with Jesse Pollock. On the afternoon of Monday, August 7, 1972, Jeanette DePalma, who lived in Springfield Township, New Jersey, which is about 30 miles outside of Manhattan, she was 16 years old. She told her mom that she was going to take a train to a friend's house. She did not arrive at the friend's house, and she did not return later on. Her parents filed a missing police report. Now, what makes this so bizarre is that 6 weeks later, Jeanette's remains would be found on top of a cliff inside a quarry near Springfield. A local dog would actually, he brought back her right forearm and hand to his owner. So this guy's sitting there, you know, in his farm or near a quarry, and his dog comes with a forearm and a hand and hands it to him. Can you imagine? Like, it'd be like if my dog came and handed me a forearm. You know, it's like, what the hell? According to several witnesses, DePalma's skeletal remains were surrounded by a series of strange and occult-like objects. So this is where the Jeanette DePalma case gets crazy. Was she killed, drug overdose? And we're going to go through all of this. I'm not rushing through it. Because he goes through all this during the interview, which is absolutely fascinating. Now, Ricky Casso, he was on a whole other thing. Ricky Casso was known as the Acid King. He killed his 17-year-old friend, Gary Lawlers, in 1984. Two other teens, Jimmy Triano and Albert Canones, they were present. What happened was Gary Lawlers had stolen 10 bags of PCP off of Ricky Casso. Now, what me and the author talk about is so true. You know, it wasn't just that he had stolen PCP from his friends. It was that mindset of even like, I know a lot of people that went to jail. And they have a strict code. Your word is all you have in jail. You're basically stripped down to your soul self. And so when you're in that position, all you have is your word. That is it. That is your integrity. So to Ricky, when Gary took 10 bags of PCP from him, it wasn't just that he stole a bag from him. Or bags. It was that you took all that he had to make it in this world. Ricky Casso had been cast aside by his parents. They were doing this tough love that was very popular in the 80s. You know, tough love, kick them out and they'll learn. Well, that's not what happens. What happens is you felt like you didn't have anybody to turn to. I can't imagine kicking my son or daughter out ever. I always thought tough love was a very poor lesson to be learned, unless they were doing something, you know, there's limits, of course. I mean, if they're killing people, or, you know, if they're stealing money from you left and right, or, you know, if it's something truly horrific, I can understand. But this kid just was a kid, and they would just kick him out for anything. So he was basically starving. He would be found like on people's couches. It was a very, you know, I got to see a different side of Ricky. And Jesse Pollock says something which is very true. After he killed Gary Lawlers, all bets were off. I mean, dude, you crossed the line. That's ridiculous. Here's the interview, and I'll give it over to Jesse. So I start by asking him just straight up about the Jeanette DePalma case in general.
Well, that was the story initially. Back when I was writing for Weird New Jersey in 2011, I was going through some old back issues that I had, trying to find the first article that I had ever written for them. And that was all the way back in, I want to say, 2004. And I found the issue. And in that same issue, there was the initial Weird New Jersey coverage of this case, which had started all the way back in like 97 or 98. There would be these readers that would write in and say, oh yeah, I saw you wrote about the haunted Watchung Reservation in Union County, but you're just scratching the surface. There was also this girl who was hitchhiking in the 70s and she vanished and a dog brought a body part.
Now he's talking about Jeanette DePalma. The dog brought the body part back. This dog just happened to get one of Jeanette's bones and bring it back to its owner.
Home. We don't know if it's an urban legend or not, but you should look into it. And so they would print these letters hoping that someone would eventually write in with more information. And eventually someone did. A reader wrote in saying, yes, the story is true. Her name was Jeanette DePalma. She was found on an altar. And so once my bosses at Weird New Jersey, Mark Skirman and Mark Moran, had this name to go on, they went back through microfiche articles at a few public libraries and eventually found the original newspaper coverage. And it was wild. It was like something out of True Detective before there even was True Detective. It was this true story of this girl who had vanished while hitchhiking to see her friend in Berkeley Heights and didn't come home that night. There was no sign of her for 6 weeks until a dog that lived with its owners in an apartment complex about, I want to say, a mile away from this rock quarry, brought home a skeletal arm. And it kicked off this this search party, and eventually they found her remains. And for a couple weeks, the story was kind of quiet. It was just, we found her skeletal remains, we don't know the cause of death, and that's all we have to go on. And then around 2 weeks after the recovery of the remains, there were all of these salacious, sensational articles popping up everywhere from the Newark Star-Ledger to the New York Daily News, talking about, oh yeah, an inside source at the police department says that that this is being investigated as a ritual crime, that supposedly there were these occult objects found around the body, and that investigators were bringing a witch to the crime scene to, verify these things. The rumor mill was incredible. As far as the newspapers went, the coverage was just that supposedly she was found within a trapezoidal perimeter of logs that resembled a coffin, and that there were little sticks around the body that resembled crosses. But then, of course, you know, when you get into the scuttlebutt of small town America in the early 70s, you know, this was right around the time of Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist and all that. It was, oh no, I heard that she was found with animal sacrifices around her. And then other people say, oh no, I heard it was an altar and that there were little arrows carved in the trees in a trail leading to the body. Of course, none of this turned out to be true, but it was the world's greatest game of telephone at the time, and it really scared the hell out of a lot of people. I interviewed several residents from the area at that time that said, oh yeah, we weren't allowed to trick-or-treat that year, because my parents were convinced that, yeah, the parents of this community were convinced that teenaged Satanists or witches, because that was what this was blamed on. The newspapers would alternate between, oh, it was a group of teenage devil worshipers that were meeting in the area. Or they would say, oh no, it was a coven of witches from the nearby Watchung Reservation, which is a whole other crazy thing that Mark Moran and myself go into in our book Death on the Devil's Teeth, not far from where this young woman's remains were recovered is, and again, this is like something out of a horror movie at the time, a large patch of sacred Native American land called the Watchung Reservation. It's up in the mountains. There are hiking trails, horse stables. There's a deserted workers' village that's abandoned sitting in the middle of it. Multiple colonial era graveyards, things like that. And at the time, the authorities were finding evidence of what you could consider rituals, but in all likelihood was, you know, probably bored teenagers that had read the Satanic Bible too many times. Like, they were finding pentagram graffiti, chickens that had been cut up, supposedly, stuff like that. And so when they found this girl's body in the woods so close to Halloween, and with all of these other rumors in the area, it was like, oh, well, the kids that are cutting up chickens, they finally killed a kid. So, and it all lent into it. Like, it would be really easy to just say, oh, you know, it was just idiot townsfolk making things up. But when you had for years leading up to this, the reports of this strange activity in the reservation, and then about half a mile away from the reservation, only 9 months before, you had an accountant named John List murdered his entire family and stacked all the bodies up in the ballroom of his mansion and disappeared for 18 years. The cops then were even trying to say it was some sort of bizarre ritual because his daughter, Patricia, who was coincidentally around Jeanette's age, they did not know each other, but Patricia told friends at Westfield High School, oh yeah, you know, I'm a witch. I have an altar in the woods. And they found witchcraft books in the house, in her room. That was part of the reason he gave. She had acted in local plays, mostly through Westfield High School. And she had apparently told the family that she wanted to go to Hollywood and become an actress. And List was this repressed Christian. I believe he was a Lutheran. And that was the excuse he gave. Oh, I killed my family because, you know, they were turning away from God. But the real reason was the guy was in debt up to his eyeballs. He couldn't hold a job. He was skimming off of his elderly mother's Social Security checks. And the bank was in the process of repossessing this house. So he just decided, yeah, I know. And he just decided to, you know, instead of going on welfare or, you know, maintaining a job, oh, I'm just going to go kill my family and go start another one in Colorado. He moved to Virginia first, I believe. He changed his name to Bob Clark, and then he got a job as a fry cook in a restaurant, and then eventually worked his way back up to being an accountant out there, and then eventually moved to Colorado. And I believe that's where he met his second wife. It was much easier to change your identity back then in the pre-digital era. But yeah, it was a mess. Oh, you could go all the way up to the gate. Yeah.
We were talking about how you could go all the way up to the gate if you were going to the airport.
Name you wanted and pay in cash and they would have no record of you. And oh yeah, it was just like D.B. Cooper. You know, you could walk up and give any name you wanted and pay in cash and they would have no record of you. And part of the story of the List case that a lot of people have forgotten in the years since, the FBI was actually investigating at one point if John List was D.B. Cooper, because the hijacking had happened shortly after he had murdered his family and fled, and he dumped his car at Newark Airport to throw the authorities off, but List actually took a bus to Virginia. So people thought he had become a skyjacker, and there are some similarities between the FBI sketch of Cooper and List, but it was, of course, eventually ruled out. But, you know, there was that whole thing that had happened near the reservation, and then only 2.5 years after Jeanette's remains were found not far away, there was a young man by the name of Greg Sanders who chopped up his parents with an axe and then climbed to the top of a water tower in the reservation and committed suicide. So it was within this small, teeny little area in Union County in the early 1970s, there was this just hotbed of incredibly bizarre and brutal crime, and it scared the hell out of a lot of people. And that whole weird area and time frame made up the genesis of Mark and myself writing this book. It was in Springfield, New Jersey, about, I want to say, 25 minutes outside of Manhattan. And Springfield is about two towns away from where I grew up. I grew up in Clark. And it was just this patch of woods off the side of a road, Mount View Road in Springfield, that bordered a rock quarry. And a lot of the initial reports we would get in Weird New Jersey from people who remembered it, they would say, oh yeah, it was near an abandoned rock quarry. But Mark and myself, we later found out that no, it was an operational work site at the time. I believe that there was a dynamite blast that day even. So the idea, because a lot of people have tried to sort of postulate in the years since, that, like, oh, well, maybe she went into the woods with her friends, because they never found a physical cause of death. There were no bullet holes, no knife marks, nothing. Best they could figure was she was possibly strangled because there was no other physical evidence to go on. They had a pile of bones in the woods, and that was it. There were people that, you know, would come out and say, well, maybe she went and was partying in the woods and overdosed and died there. But this was a Monday afternoon in the middle of the summer, on a road where you could not pull a car over and park without being noticed by the police. It's a two-lane blacktop with no shoulder. And yeah, it was not a party spot. You know, like, if you're with your friends and you're like, oh, let's go in the woods and do some hard drugs that could kill you in one shot, you're not going to go do it next to an operational work site on a Monday. Yeah, Mark and I always thought that that theory was ridiculous, and we honestly thought the witchcraft theories were ridiculous too, and we wanted to find out some more information about the physical evidence on that scene, and we would put these record requests in through the New Jersey Open Public Records Act and the Freedom of Information Act, saying, you know, could we see a crime scene photo or read a redacted report, you know, to verify what was supposedly found around her. Because if we interviewed the cops that were there on the scene that day, including the patrol officer who first found the remains, and no two of them agree on what was found. You know, one officer would say, oh yeah, you know, there was no logs around her, but there were crosses made out of sticks. Another officer would say, oh yeah, no, there were no sticks around her, but there was a circle of stones near her that I thought was a fire pit. And then another officer would say, no, nothing was found around her. It was just a body. So when you have all of these people and you know, respectable people, like authoritative, these are the officers who were on the scene that day, not agreeing, you're like, okay, well, it's got to be the fog of time or something like that. By the time Mark and myself, when we were writing the book, it was 40 years later, we were like, okay, well, we'll go back to the original reports when it was still fresh in everyone's memory. And the Springfield Police Department would say, oh, no, we can't give you anything. It was all destroyed in a flood in 1999. You know, for the longest time, that was all we had. And then other people would say, no, that's bullshit. The prosecutor's office has to have a copy of the case file. And then that kicked off this decade-long back and forth between the prosecutor's office and myself, where it was, at one point they would say, oh yeah, we have it, but we can't give it to you because it's an open case. And then you would send another request and they would say, oh yeah, well, we looked and we can't find any crime scene photos in our file. And then you'd send another request and they would fall back on, oh no, it's an open case, blah, 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 blah. And then finally in February of this year, after 2 years of going back and forth on one specific records request, they released the bulk of the case file to us. They released the crime scene photos with the body blacked out. And you can see there was no satanic stuff whatsoever. There were no pentagrams. There was no altar. There were some fallen tree branches around the body that, if you look close, kind of look like a trapezoid, but it's clear that they had been there for years, if not decades. Random people in the police department looking at some logs around her just went, oh yeah, that might be satanic.
That's crazy how that happens. And it's, you know, because I do remember that point when everything was satanic. Everyone wants something to be more, I guess,
outrageous than it actually is, it seems. And then that's probably what, you know, their memories were not. That's why every officer probably gave a different account, because it's almost like you want to put it there, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. The officers that said that there was nothing around her body were usually the ones that were like, oh, no, she probably overdosed and died there.
Wow.
And then, you know, the ones that said, oh, yeah, we did see there were some sticks and things, they were the ones that were like, we think she was murdered.
What do you think happened?
Our operating theory since day one was that she was likely the victim of a serial killer, because we started looking into other similar murders of young women around that time in New Jersey, and we found out that there was another young woman killed in the exact same way only 8 days later and 6 miles away, and that was a young woman named Joan Kramer She was visiting her family in South Orange. She was a student at Columbia University in Manhattan at the time. And she had gotten into an argument with her fiancé and decided to walk into downtown South Orange to, I guess, just blow off some steam or whatever.
Right.
She called a friend of hers from a payphone, and her friend said, no, go home, take a cab home. And instead of waiting for a cab, she walked to the corner of this main drag in South Orange and got into a stranger's car while hitchhiking. And she vanished that night. And then the same with Jeanette. Weeks later, they found Joan's remains face down in a wooded area. There were similar items missing. Like, for instance, when Jeanette's body was found, she was missing a cross, a golden cross necklace that she had been seen leaving the house wearing that day. And same with Joan Kramer. A necklace was missing from her body. Kramer was not in as advanced state, an advanced state of decomposition as Jeanette had been, and they were able to determine that she was strangled. So it started to make sense to Mark and me that, okay, obviously there was a pattern killer.
Yeah.
Around the same time, because I mean, what other explanation could there be? Like, that would be one heck of a coincidence if there were two separate killers operating in a 6 mile radius targeting the same type of victim. Both Jeanette and Joan were pretty young white girls with long, straight, shoulder length hair parted in the middle and had a thin frame. And they were brunettes.
And the fact that both their necklaces, like, was that his, like, way of taking, you know, a keepsake?
Yeah.
That is interesting.
And both were hitchhikers, they weren't dismembered and hidden. They weren't in a shallow grave. They weren't burned. They were just strangled and left in the place that they were killed. They weren't dump jobs. They weren't concealed. It was just, they were strangled in the spot and left there face down. And they were in wooded areas around Union County. Like Jeanette, she vanished from Springfield and was found only 2 miles away from her home, still within the Springfield township limits, I'm sorry. And Joan Kramer was abducted from South Orange, but her body was found in the township of Union, which borders Springfield. So it's like right in that same area. So it began to make sense to us that, okay, whoever killed Joan Kramer likely killed Jeanette DePalma as well.
Interesting.
Our working theory that it was most likely a serial killer that picked up hitchhikers. And we've, even though the book came out coming up on 7 years ago, we're still investigating leads that, you know, people will pick up the book, you know, at a Barnes & Noble and go, oh my God, I remember this. And then they'll email us with information. So we're working on an expanded and revised edition of the book
that's going to
have a whole bunch of new information, especially from, you know, the case file that was just released to us this year. And we're hoping to have that new edition of the book out by next summer.
And is Weird Magazine still out, or is it online, or is it? Reading Weird Magazine.
Just released an issue just a couple months ago, and we've got a new one that will be coming out in October next month. That's got a whole batch of new and interesting articles and interview pieces and all that. And
that's
you can find it at Weird NJ.
lindenj.com. And I believe even with shipping, it's under $10 to have it shipped to
you. Oh, that's, I remember.
In the New Jersey area, every Barnes & Noble carries.
Yes, Barnes & Noble. That's where I used to get it. I remember that magazine. I absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because Barnes & Noble has all of the, they still have like those old, well, in England, still does like the True Detective kind of magazines.
He had a lot of problems. He did make a movie about the Ricky Casso case, but he had a little bit of issues getting it put out there.
That all happened. Backtracking a little bit, after I had started writing the Casso book, The Acid King, back in, it was actually right after Death on the Devil's Teeth came out, my agent contacted me, and he said, hey, I just had lunch with an editor over at Barnes & Noble, and they want to start a true crime line of books that are directed at teenagers, like young
adults. Right. I've seen it in the back of The Acid King. It actually has a few stories, you know, a few books that are kind of, I can picture them in my head, but it was, I thought you had written them all. Here, they're different authors.
No, all different authors.
Yeah.
And my agent Eric said, you know, they're interested in you writing one. The only stipulation is they would like it to be a case that is teenager-centric, meaning that the killer and the victim were both teenagers. And I had heard about the Ricky Casso case while researching the Satanic Panic for Death on the Devil's Teeth, and I always kept thinking about it, like, wow.
That is...
What a crazy story that is.
Yes.
I knew at the time there had already been another book, Say You Love Satan, but I didn't know at the time that book was largely fictional.
Yeah, that's what people were complaining about. Yes, I did read that.
And so I figured that I would write this quick little book for Barnes & Noble that would build on the reporting that had been done in Say You Love Satan and conduct new interviews and have a fresher take on it. And it was only once I started interviewing people from Northport that had lived the story that they immediately started telling me, oh, no, the guy that wrote that book was a trash hack, tabloid journalist. He made all that crap up. And then I realized, oh, my God, this is an opportunity to tell
the real story. And that was, the reviews were mostly saying, like, this is the real, like, the people must have written in, like, in Amazon, the reviews were like, this is the story. Because I had originally read Say Yes to Satan years ago, and they were like, that is so not how it went. The Acid King is much more the true story. But it is crazy because you really put the reader in the story. Like, it's amazing. You feel like you know these teenagers.
Well, I really lucked out with it because a lot of them, obviously not Ricky or Gary, the young man that he had murdered, they were not around anymore. But so many of their friends and other people that were, you know, peripherally a part of the story, they were all still around, and 99% of them were like, yeah, I'll be interviewed by you because, you know, what David St. Clair wrote in Say You Love Satan was not true, and this is an opportunity to get it out there. So I conducted in-depth interviews for 3 years with these people, and then there was this other side story with it that I found incredibly interesting. For years, the people that were in the know about how Say You Love Satan was just a bullshit, you know, pulp paperback, would direct people, no, you should read the Rolling Stone article that David Breskin wrote. David Breskin actually came to Northport as this thing happened within days of Ricky's arrest and lived among Ricky and Gary's friends for weeks getting the true story. And I read the piece, and it's an amazing piece of journalism. Like, Rolling Stone even selected it as one of their most iconic stories when it came time to release the 20th anniversary book. I think it's called 20 Great Stories. So I reached out to David Breskin just to interview him about his recollections of working on this story. And after talking to him about all this stuff that happened behind the scenes while he was writing, you know, this article, I was like, oh my God, this is a book within itself. It's such a captivating story about how he was trying to, you know, dig past all these rumors of an occult sacrifice and all this crazy crap. It became a detective story almost. And he offered up to me, he goes, I still have all 44 hours of my interview tapes. And so he, God, this, looking back, this was so risky. And I can't thank him enough for doing this. He boxed up his original tapes and mailed them to me for me to digitize and transcribe. And that was a process that took 3 months. So in addition to my, I think I had 30 hours of interviews that I had done myself, I now have 44 hours that were conducted within days of the crime happening. And he had interviewed several people that had already passed on. So he was able to fill in the blanks that were literally impossible for me to cover, because these tapes were a literal time machine.
Yeah.
And they reached across the veil of death.
Because it had people that weren't even alive still. That's amazing. Well, yeah,
no, several, you know, a few passed within a year or two of the article coming out. Some had passed only, like, the lead detective on the case, I missed out on interviewing him by, like, 3 weeks or something. He had died right before I started work on the book. So okay. I had the real reason why The Acid King was such a success in telling that story so thoroughly wasn't because I'm, like, some great Truman Capote journalist or anything like that.
But it's really good.
Well, thank you. But it wouldn't have been anywhere near as good if I didn't have access to that wealth of archival material through David Breskin and the willingness of all these people from Northport to come forward and tell their story. Like, if all I had to go on was the microfiche articles at the Northport Public Library, the book would have been a total failure. Because even the sincere reporting done by some of the local press back then was flawed.
Okay, I mean, one of the things I absolutely love that you did, it seems little, but you don't even know. I think every author should do this. In the beginning, you have a list of everybody of importance and then what they represent, like his best friend, because names become confusing. And like I don't have the book right in front of me, unfortunately, but I can remember it says, like, you know, Ricky Caso, the literal killer in the story, Gary, the person he killed, the best friend, you know, that Jimmy Triani, what's his last name? Jimmy
Troiano.
You know, and everybody in there you had listed and what they represented in the book, and it just helped so much, because when I came to that character, especially if it wasn't one that was like the big three or four, you could go back and see exactly who they were. It just helps.
The reason I laugh at that is at the time, that was a, I can't even call it a suggestion. It was an order that came down from Simon & Schuster. They were like, no, you need to do this. And at the time, I fought against it.
Really?
Yeah, because I was really, because they wanted to call it a cast of characters. The story is so deep.
It really is. It's not just about this kid, because my friend years ago, God rest his soul, that was his favorite book was Say Yes to Satan, and I wish that he had read, I mean, he had died a long time ago. He just loved that book for whatever reason, and he never read The Acid King, and I would love for him to have, but he told me the whole story. And now when I look back, I'm like, God, he didn't even really read the whole story. You know, he just read, you know, like you said, what they put out there. And it wasn't what they have out there and what was in your book. And now what I put together, it is so much more of a deeper story. It's not just this kid killing this kid. I mean, I know it was over 5 bags or 10 bags of PCP, but there was so much more that went into it.
Oh, yeah, and it was just like the diploma case. There was all this lead-up to it that when this crime finally happened, everyone was ready to blame it on the occult. And the whole story about the Knights of the Black
Circle
being this satanic cult, it just ended up being so ridiculous. Because, you know, if you were to Google Ricky Caso, I mean, forget before my book came out, even today you'll still find articles where people are like, oh yeah, Ricky Casso, he was the leader of the teenage Satan cult Knights of the Black Circle. And then you interview people from Northport, and then you find out, no, not only were they not a satanic cult, they were all older than Ricky by several years. They were like, you know.
Yeah, how did they get smooshed in with the story?
It was just ridiculous. They were a group of pot dealers. They weren't even hardcore drug dealers like Ricky was.
Right.
You know, Ricky was selling
like hardcore,
angel dust to possibly heroin at 17 years old. But these kids who were around in the mid to late 70s, they were these hippies. They called themselves the last of the hippies, and they would all congregate in this park at the foot of Main Street in Northport, right at the harbor, and they would play Grateful Dead songs and Bob Dylan songs and sell pot out of their guitar cases. Well, because they had this is so funny now, because, you know, Spooky Nights, the Black Circle, but these kids were such wimps that people from East Northport and Kings Park, other drug dealers, would come to downtown Northport and beat them up and steal their weed.
Oh my God.
Eventually, they were like, we've got to do something about this. So they came up with the idea that it wasn't even like leather jackets. These were, you know.
Yeah, I saw the jackets. Yeah,
they were denim jackets, and they painted some pentagrams and dragons on the back and wrote Knights of the Black Circle, to spook these people away from stealing their weed.
And I asked
the guy that co-founded this quote-unquote brotherhood or group or whatever you want to call it, because they weren't a cult. And he said, well, where did that name Knights of the Black Circle come from? That's so spooky. And he said, it was a play on Knights of the Round Table. And I'm like, King Arthur? And he's like, yeah. And he goes, the Black Circle, he goes, you remember those wooden table spools that we all used to, you know, turn into like a coffee table in our first apartments? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, we had one in the woods where we would hang out, and it was painted black. And so we said, this is our round table, the Black Circle. So it had nothing to do with satanic knights and, you know, black voids and all that. These guys thought that they were King Arthur and his baronet.
Oh my God, that is so funny. Because
when the press got a hold of it, they were like, oh, there was a satanic killing in the woods. They must have had something to do with that cult that was walking around with the pentagrams on their back, the Knights of the Black Circle. Ricky must have been the leader. And he barely knew them. He wasn't even part of their social scene.
That's
where it all became very interesting for me while writing the book was, okay, it's not just an A to Z telling of a crime. It's a detective story trying to find out how this all became this ridiculous mess.
Yes. And I know what you mean, because my friend used to play Dungeons and Dragons. And when they moved, there was this big thing that there was this dog hanging from the basement, and it was all untrue. I knew them. I'm like, that's not true. They just used to play Dungeons and Dragons. They had a tire hanging in the basement. There was no dog hanging from the basement.
Oh, it's always some dog. That happened in this story, too. There was a National Enquirer article that claimed that the Knights of the Black Circle, along with Ricky Casso, their quote-unquote leader, had sacrificed a dog by drowning it.
I did read that.
And the true story was the dog ran away with its leash still attached, and the leash got caught on a rock, and the dog was fine. There was a police report about it because a cop walking by saw the dog and rescued it. The dog was still alive at the time that they were reporting that it had been sacrificed.
It was
that ridiculous.
That is, it's amazing how they twist things.
Unbelievable. It's a dragons thing, like the new gen. And I'm not trying to sound like a boomer.
I know what you mean.
Will never understand, like now it's kind of cutesy. Like if you put on Stranger Things on Netflix, it's like, oh, look at these cute little
dogs. Yes.
I don't understand. Like, no, parents back then were like, oh my God, my son's playing Dungeons and Dragons. He's a Satanist. I need to send him to this camp or military school. Like, people were terrified of that shit back then. It wasn't, oh, look at these adorable dorks.
Oh my God. What happened across from us? The guy, the mother had left, and the dad was a truck driver. Now, the daughter, she was my friend, so she was always over my house. But her brother and his friends played Dungeons & Dragons. That's all they did. But that was in the neighborhood. Everyone was like, oh, my God, what's going on in that house? They're playing Dungeons & Dragons. Like you said, it was this horrific thing. And it was like, that's all they did was play Dungeons & Dragons. It was no, there was no satanic anything going on over there. I was her friends with the daughter. I mean, they were as normal as normal. Like you said, they were just a bunch of dorks sitting around the table. But it became, that house is so creepy. And it was only because the dad was a truck driver, so he wasn't home a lot. And that's it. That was the whole big story. But it became this mythological house. And like I said, when they left, they said there was all this stuff found in the back. I was her friend. I know there was nothing. I was there. You know,
they were looking at anything back then. And yes. It's honestly the cultural villainization of a generation of latchkey kids.
In right.
This was the first generation where both parents were going to work. So you had all these kids with free time. You know, they were playing Dungeons & Dragons. They were listening to heavy metal. They were smoking
right.
pot.
Yes.
And if they were kids from the other side of the tracks, it was really easy for the hoity-toity Christians area to go, oh, those poor kids listening to, you know, heavy metal and playing this board game.
Yes.
They must be Satanists. I hear that they have a dog hanging in their basement.
Yes, that's exactly. It was like, oh my God, I was there. But it did become this huge thing. And Dungeons and Dragons will forever remind me of that house. And nothing happened, but it does.
Okay,
you know.
I talked to people about this, and I really tried to get this across in my book because it's such an alien concept for a lot of people to understand that, like, how scary it was to be into that stuff. I mean, one of the biggest reasons why Ricky Casso was turned into this teenage boogeyman was because he happened to be arrested while wearing an AC/DC shirt.
That's
and everyone
right.
lost their shit over that.
I remember.
By the time he died, it's so surreal. Yeah,
and explain.
Like, the real trip for me was my next book that I'm working on now, the follow-up to The Acid King, is about the Sid Vicious Nancy Spungen story.
He is going to write about Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, but he does go back and forth about the Acid King here.
Years ago,
I
saw a car commercial, and it had Sid Vicious's cover of My Way in it, and I was
like, yes!
You know, this, oh, everybody hated it back then because people were putting safety pins in their cheeks or whatever. But it's like, this guy was busted for killing his girlfriend.
Yes.
They're selling Mazdas with it or whatever.
I know.
So surreal. You know?
Oh, that's going to be awesome. Oh, I'm fascinated with that story. That's going to be great.
And that's another story that I
did create a podcast about that, but I didn't want to interject.
Every single time I pick one of these cases, I'm like, oh, this will just be a simple A to Z telling of this case. And now that I'm into it, it's like, oh my God, there is so much about this story that the general public doesn't know.
Oh, I can't wait. I am so excited.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
I am so fascinated by that. Even like, I know it was so romanticized, but even back then when they made that movie with Gary Oldman, at their interview, Sid doesn't even stay awake during half of the...
Oh, yeah, she's on the dock.
Yes. She's always the one that's like, Sid, wake up.
Yeah.
You know, but so with Ricky Casso, he was homeless, basically. He was kicked out of his house when he was a young boy. I mean,
yeah, he was kicked out, and it depends on who you ask. Like, some of his friends remember it happening in sixth grade, others remember it being somewhere closer to seventh. But either way, by the time he died at 17 years old, he had been homeless and living in the woods or sleeping in the woods.
Now, Ricky Casso would ultimately kill himself when he was on trial for the murder of his friend Gary Lawlers. He would hang himself in his cell. At the age of 17.
Or is he broken into for 3 or 4 years by that? You know, his formative years. Because his father was this control freak football coach who wanted his son to be the next Johnny Unitas. And the second that his son was, you know, into... Like, people think, like... And that was the other interesting revelation with this book. It was like, oh my God, Ricky Casso. He was this thrash metal, speed metal dude who was thrown out for being so intense. Like, I interviewed Ricky's sister. Ricky wasn't even, like, a big heavy metal guy. That AC/DC shirt he was arrested in was given to him by a friend after he fell in the harbor and needed a change of clothes. Ricky was into The Who, The Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, he was really into. So none of this hard rock shit that he was later associated with. And his father just saw him going down this path of, oh no, my son isn't interested in football anymore. He's growing his hair long. He smokes pot and he's playing guitar. And threw him out over it.
I knew a young kid. He died young too, but from a car accident. But the same thing. He did not fit to where his dad. And he was a good kid, but he kicked him out when he was 13 years old. And I believe that's why, through a series of weird events, he died. He never killed anybody, but he died young. But I do believe, like you said, it was that era of tough love. He wasn't becoming what his dad wanted him to be. It sounds so similar. So Ricky probably just did what he had to do to survive, which was to sell drugs.
Exactly. He was selling drugs to make enough money to buy a pack of bologna and a thing of white bread to, make sandwiches in the woods where he was literally sleeping next to a campfire on dirt. At one point, he found a couch that was being thrown out, and he brought it up there. But by the time winter hit, the wood was so wet in the woods, he had to burn the couch to stay warm.
Oh, my God.
And he was constantly contracting pneumonia and lung infections in the woods, and he would go home, and his folks would put him in the hospital for a little bit, and they would tell him, like, okay, you can come home and stay home, but the second you use a curse word in the house, you're out again.
Oh,
and so, like, a week later, he'd say the F word, and they're like, nope, you're out, bye.
That is crazy. I mean, do you think some of what, like, when he did kill Gary, do you think some of it was built up anger about all of this, like being, like, basically, his parents made him into be like a monster that he wasn't? But the killing, I'm trying to think what would make him so angry to actually do it, and that's the part that baffles me. Like, what?
I think it all boiled over, to be honest. I think you're hitting the nail on the head there. By that time, when you're living in the woods or, crashing on friends' couches from night to night until their parents throw you out, or you're breaking into cars. I mean, at one point, he was sleeping on a public bathroom floor.
Oh, my God.
Smelling piss and shit all night.
And he was just pissed.
I think it all just eventually boiled over. Like, here was a kid who, and I'm not justifying what he did to Gary Powers, but I'm understanding it. Here was a kid he had known since at least second grade who, broke, like, the code of friendship in his mind. Like, he stole...
That was all he had.
PCP out of his jacket while he was sleeping. And it's like, forget, that's my drugs. It was also like, well, that's my only way of making money, and I don't have a home.
That's all he had. Yeah, I can see. I mean, well, I know, like, what you said. It's not like it sucks what happened, but and also that possibly that's why, because he does kill himself. I mean, I get maybe when he was in jail, he started thinking, like, what do I have after this? I don't want to spend the rest of my life in jail, like, regretting it. I wonder, did he regret it at that point?
I think it could have all been one big act of suicide, honestly. He probably thought his life was over, and, it was obviously a rage killing, and he was under the influence of PCP at the time.
Yeah.
So, I think he realized that he had nothing left to live for, took Gary out with him, and then as soon as he was arrested, he committed suicide. And that was the other thing that led to the huge media circus here. Ricky was no longer around to say, no, I killed this guy because he stole drugs from me. So the cops and the press had free rein to tell the rest of the world, no, this was a cult killing, it was a satanic sacrifice. And don't get me wrong, Ricky Castle was into Satan, but he was into Satan the way that dweebs were back then.
Right.
He had the satanic Bible, listened to Ozzy. Yeah. You know? But not even like solo Ozzy. He was into like old Black Sabbath, which was, you know, it was 15 years old at that point. So yeah, he was into that the way like kids are into like Lovecraft.
Now. Right. That's true. Yeah. And the other guy got, he was acquitted. Right?
Well, yeah, because once Casso was dead, you know, the state was kind of caught with their pants down, and someone had to go down for this. So they tried charging Jimmy Triano. And the witness testimony was completely unreliable. The only state's witness they had to it was the only other guy that was there that night, a kid named Albert Canones. And he was so messed up on drugs that, you know, he was constantly contradicting himself on the stand. Like, the defense tore his testimony apart. So he was acquitted, but he ended up going to jail for 15 years anyway for a string of bank robberies.
Really?
Jimmy Triano has spent more of his life in jail than Al, kind of like Manson.
Oh my God, that is crazy. Now, Ricky Casso have a girlfriend during the book?
That's a big myth with this case, too, that Ricky Casso was this loser that no one liked, and, you know, girls were repulsed by him, and he was this monster. But no, he was popular. Girls liked him. He had a lot of friends. One of the most telling things when I was doing the research for this book was David Breskin went to Gary Lowers' wake and recorded it with his tape recorder, and he's outside the funeral home talking to, like, Ricky and Gary were in the same group of friends, so all of Gary's friends were Ricky's friends too, and there were just as many people crying for Ricky at Gary's wake than there were for Gary. And these poor kids were so torn and conflicted. They were like, oh my God, you know, Gary's dead, but my friend Ricky killed him. And even then they're saying, like, Ricky wasn't a bad guy, but he was thrown away by his family and had to fend for himself. He was mentally ill. He was diagnosed as manic depressive, which we now know is bipolar disorder. Right. He was completely unmedicated for that, and he was self-medicating
with drugs.
PCP, which is the worst. Great when you're 16 years old, you know?
No, that stuff is, ugh. That used to be big and hard. Like,
waiting to go off, unfortunately, and it did. These kids had no real support from their families. Like, the biggest dirty little secret about Northport while I was writing this book was Northport to this day wants the world to believe that Ricky Casso was an anomaly. That, oh no, he was this feral child that lived in the woods and dug up graves for, you know, drug money. And killed this kid, but that's not what we're like around here. I've talked to people back then, and this is even on David Breskin's interview tapes from almost 40 years ago now. There were at the very least 24 other teenagers in Ricky Casso's group of friends who were just like him, thrown out by their parents that didn't want to deal with him anymore, sleeping on benches in the park, sleeping on friends' couches, breaking into cars. There was a culture of abandonment in this town because parents just, you know, didn't want to deal with their kids. They believed in this tough love bullshit of, oh, if I throw my kid out enough, they'll eventually get it together. And no, it was like,
they need guidance.
These kids were cast out by their families, and that's all they had was each other, and they turned to drug use, they turned to stealing, and it eventually boiled over into violence and ultimately murder.
God, it just makes so much sense now. It really does, the way you said it. The only thing he had was, like, your word, and then when that guy, Gary, stole from him, it meant more than just stealing a bunch of bags of PCP. It was like, that was, you know, you, I was sleeping and you were taking, like you said, that's his whole soul way of making, to get anything, like food.
But yeah, he saw it as an ultimate betrayal, you know, like, and one of the myths is, like, they were from two separate cliques of friends, and there was always this animosity. They were friends, they were close, you know, they weren't best friends by any means, but like I said, they've known each other since second grade, they grew up together, and, you know, only a day or two before, Ricky's father had thrown $2 at him in front of all of his friends, in front of the bagel shop, saying, here's $2 to get breakfast. Don't ever call the house again. Don't ever talk to your mother, your sisters, or me ever again. We're wiping our hands of you. You're done. And then 24 hours later, you know, one of the only people he has left in his life, his friend Gary, you know, like, he's stolen this stuff from him. I think he just, I do think it was almost like an act of suicide. Like, I'm going to kill myself anyway. My life is over. I'm taking this guy out with me. I mean, he wasn't, you could try to rationalize it, but he also wasn't thinking straight.
Right.
He had a head full of PCP and he was mentally ill. So any sort of way to put this in a context that's easily understandable to a rational person is kind of a fool's errand in and of itself. So the only real, realistic task that I had was just to provide as much context as possible, because the alternate explanation makes no sense. Oh, you know, he did this because he listened to Ozzy Osbourne and read the Satanic Bible.
Yeah.
Like, that's not true.
It does put it into perspective. It's almost like he becomes a sympathetic person. I mean, like you said, it doesn't justify what he did, but it definitely makes more sense.
And, no, my sympathy ends for him the moment that he killed Gary Lowers. That
right.
was the point of no return there. But I do sympathize with the abuse that he went through on behalf of his family, and how the schools that he was going to failed him and the community failed him. But I never wanted this story to be like this spooky, you know,
untrue
satanic murder. But it's more of a tragedy to me, because until that knife went into Gary Lowers, this was all preventable.
Yes. I mean, what do you think could have happened that night? I mean, just as like playing devil's advocate, like, what do you think could have happened that would stop that? I mean, anything, or it was just bound to happen? I often think, like, if there was somebody else there, or I don't know.
I honestly think that, there were two other people there that night that could have stopped Ricky, that could have gotten the knife out of his hand, but Jimmy Troiano was just as much of a damaged person as Ricky, if not more.
Yeah.
He was given up for adoption when he was only a few weeks old, if I remember correctly, and then spent the next several years in an orphanage.
Oh, yeah.
So he had no concept of, like, a traditional
family.
And I'm not saying that in the conservative sense. Like, he had no one mothering him.
Right.
He just lived in a building with other abandoned kids, essentially, and had to fend for himself. His mind didn't work the way that other people did. Like, a family eventually adopted him, and they tried very hard with him, but I think, like, the trauma and the damage had been done by that point.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
By the time the murder happened, he had already been arrested several times for theft. I think, even Gary had been arrested for assault at one point.
Oh, wow.
You know, this was a community of violent kids that were stealing shit all the time because they were left to fend for themselves.
Yeah.
And Albert Quinonez, the star witness for the state, he was known as a brawler in Northport. He was on the wrestling team. He was constantly getting in fights with people. So I think all of them in the woods that night, you know, with their own individual trauma.
It was a recipe for disaster.
For disaster. None of those people were going to save Gary Lowers.
Yeah.
You know, if other rational people had been there, maybe he would have had a chance. But those two were just as guilty, in my opinion, as Ricky was. They did not help matters at all.
Yeah. I mean, I know what you mean. I just remember, like you said, growing up, there was a lot of drugs where I grew up. And if there was a fight that started, it was always, you would have a bunch of kids like, go, fight. And then there was other kids would be like trying to break it up. And it would all depend on who was there that night, how far there was always fights for some reason.
Northport had a culture of that back then. One of the guys that I interviewed for the book, he was a kid then, but obviously he's an older guy now. He had told me, he goes, oh yeah, if you had beef with another student in the class and it boiled over into the classroom, the teacher would literally go, okay, we're going outside, and he would take you out on the front lawn of Northport High School and go, okay, duke it out.
Wow.
Teachers would encourage fights. There were teachers there that would assault kids. That, like, I'm not trying to sound like a liberal crybaby.
Right.
Like, I'm sure some listeners math teacher, a guy named Mr. Worm. He would, with a funny name.
How appropriate.
Mr. Worm, if he saw someone sleeping in class, he would grab them by the back of their hair and slam their heads on the table. Oh, if you did that now, you're going to jail.
And you're right, there was a lot of things. There was fights. It was this one little park right outside our school. Teachers knew what went on there. And as you said, in today's world, there would be people arrested, but nobody ever stopped anything. It was duke it out. Let them work it out amongst themselves. That was the absolute attitude.
And people in Northport knew what Ricky's father had been doing to him, you know, beating him, throwing him through the door.
Oh, God.
He chased him down a street with a pair of scissors one time because he wanted to get a haircut. Everyone knew that Ricky was sleeping in the woods because of him. But the whole attitude was, it's not your kid. Mind your own business.
And people did. They would kind of shy away. There's much more delving into now. Like, people, if they see... Back then, I mean, there was wife abuse that was on my street.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody would get involved. I mean, it is a lot different now. People tend more to either call 911 or try to talk to the person. There was none of that when I grew up. I mean, it was keep to yourself. That's none of your business. That was the attitude. And we saw a lot of, like, abuse with, like I said, like, there was spousal abuse. You just weren't supposed to get involved. That was the general consensus.
The true legacy of this story. Again, it wasn't some, like, spooky, heavy metal murder story. I think the legacy of this story is abuse and trauma boiling over in a community that failed its most vulnerable people.
Abuse and trauma boiling over and failing its most vulnerable people. That's what I wanted to end on. Now, I had a lot going into this. For some reason, this episode was a little rough for me to get out, but it was an excellent interview. I deeply appreciate Jesse Pollock getting in touch with me, interviewing with me, and again, this will be a short break. Until then, I love you guys. My next will be the Manson Murders, and that'll be out in January. I'm taking a nice long holiday break. I have so many books piled up that I don't get to read for pleasure that I just want to, I will probably be doing some Murder with Bedtime with Lyndon and Stolen from Me by Lindsay episodes. We were going to get together and do some murders, whatever they want. I'm there and it's all good. I'll still be on Instagram. It's not ShopaholicDev44 anymore. It's the Right To Podcast __. I'm available if anyone wants to talk to me. If anyone wants to do a live, you can get in touch with me, Debbie Q, at therightshoepodcast.com. And everything's going to be up. I can't do the holidays and podcasts right now. It's just too crazy. I love you guys. Thank you for sticking with me. And this is Debbie Q, and you just listened to another episode of The Right Shoe. I just scared the shit out of myself. I'm telling you, my brain is not working anymore.